This episode of Hodinkee Radio is brought to you by Lucid Motors, pioneers in luxury electric vehicles. Experience the fusion of high-end technology and sustainability with Lucid. Dive into the world of EVs and design with us. We're recording again here live from Lucid Studios in Geneva.
Welcome to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. I'm here with Tony Traina and Malaika Crawford back at Lucid Studios in Geneva on day three of Watches and Wonders. We're podcasting, we're talking, we're opining. Before we do that, let's talk about what we're wearing. Tony, what watch you have on today?
Danny, first of all, how do you feel about that intro? I've done two pretty good ones, I think. You did okay, right?
I did okay, and your ad reads and everything, you're on fire. I mean, I think Ben complimented you day one. No one complimented you yesterday, but you deserved a compliment.
The big boss. Listen, we've heard the comments. We're doing a little wrist check today. Danny, start us off.
All right, I'll start us off, sure. I am wearing an Omega Seamaster Professional with the green dial, green bezel, released I think 2 years ago maybe, but it's the only modern Seamaster Diver Professional that I like because it doesn't have any of that red nonsense.
I gotta say, a provocative, slightly subversive move even, Swatch Group notably absent from Watches and Wonders.
It is the most Swiss thing. It's the most Swiss thing I could do. I am neutral in every booth I go into.
I suppose so. Malaika, wrist check.
I had to look down there to check and see what I was wearing. Rolex Explorer 1.
If you know Malaika, this is probably the watch you've seen on her wrist at some point or another. It's a classic, and that's all we have to say about that.
It's this or Serpenti. I didn't do anything else.
Here's the thing I have to say about wrist checks. It's not that I don't like wrist checks. It's that people opine about their watches when you kind of heard it all about the Rolex Explorer 1, no offense, or even the Green Dial Omega Speedmaster, or Seamaster, excuse me.
Can I just... make a sort of little kind of argument for why I wear this at watch fairs.
Please.
This is the most versatile thing you could wear at the fair.
True.
You take it off, you put it in your bag, you don't worry about it. You try other things on, and then, you know, we don't get too precious.
That's so tossing true. The Rolex in the bag. We love to hear it.
meanwhile, you're wearing... Just go ahead, Tony.
I put my Explorer in the bag, speaking of. I've got a Jaeger LeCoultre Reverso here. This is, if you followed the site, I wrote a story about the Corvo Reverso, the story of kind of the Reverso that brought back the Reverso in the 1970s. They used 1940s cases for these watches. Check out that story if you want to learn more about this watch. I'm not going to belabor the point here on this very podcast. We're here to talk about new watches and what we saw today. Danny, we are starting, of course, as I look at my notes, how could I forget that we're starting with Malaika's and yours appointment at Hermes, an appointment I was not able to go to. But I think the big news, Malaika, from Hermes is that they've introduced an entirely new line of watches. They are called the Cut. They're 36 millimeters.
Yeah.
Tell us more about them.
All right. So Hermes.
Sorry, but you always set me up and you're talking to me and then it has nothing to do with me.
You're in the.
Should we run it back? Let's run it back.
Danny, we were at this place. Malaika.
I think we just leave this in.
I like it too.
I think we leave it in because you were in the meeting and I want to. It gets to the point I want to make about these watches, but I want Malaika to start before Danny, you drop in and talk about
Sounds
the
good
cut.
So I have a sort of deep fascination with the world of Hermes and its watches because it sort of exists in its own little microcosm, right? Like Hermes are mostly making watches for their existing customers. It's like you go into Hermes and you make your way up to the top. You know, you start with a scarf or you start with whatever and you end up, hopefully, if you have the funds, buying sort of bespoke Birkins. And you're buying your watch at Hermes. You're buying everything at Hermes, right? Unless you're sort of a Cape Cod high school 15-year-old girl.
I wouldn't know. But yeah,
anyway,
sure.
I'm laying it down
you
for you.
You made direct eye contact with Tony.
I'm laying down the sort of different entry points to Hermes, you know, watches, but I think mostly it sort of exists in it as its own thing. And Tuesday, they released the Cut, and we see kind of them attempt a sort of like every man piece, maybe every woman piece, because they're marketing this as a woman's watch, but not really.
Every people.
I guess it depends on which market, the verbiage that you use, right? Like
right.
USA, unisex, maybe other markets you're saying for women. I don't know. What was interesting is that instead of shrinking the 808, they made a new watch for women, a sport watch. And actually, I'm going to say I tried it on and I really liked it.
And you said to me, this is like the one kind of watch where your taste and mine intersect.
Yeah.
Because
that
really.
That wasn't a diss.
No, it's a compliment.
Yeah, yeah. No, because here's the thing. I saw pictures of that watch and I'll be honest, it wasn't, you know, the most dazzling thing I've seen. No. But I knew that when I saw it in real life, I was going to like it because it's Hermes, so it's well designed. Everything is proportionally correct. The typography is very nice.
Very nice.
Yeah. And it looked great on you and it looked great on me, if I do say so myself. Interchangeable straps, the whole shebang.
Well, Danny, this is where I wanted to tee you up a little bit because it's a 36 millimeter watch, like you said, like a marketed towards women. However, I'm in any number of group chats, watch related group chats, and
I'm not.
How many?
I said any number, Danny.
Okay, got it. Got it.
I put them all on mute, honestly.
WhatsApp or iMessage? You know you're deep when it's WhatsApp.
Yeah, okay. Sure. I don't let people into the iMessage, honestly.
Okay. That's personal.
It's personal.
All right, so what's the tea?
Okay, a lot of folks in my tiny corner of the world that are talking about these jewelry watches, these design-driven, smaller vintage watches, Malika, we've talked about these types of things on the podcast before.
I roll.
They're looking at the 36 millimeter, the cut, and they're saying, ah, interesting. So, Danny, from your perspective, what are we looking at?
That was more offensive than the intersection of taste thing.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. No, it's I knew... we had heard about this watch, I think, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I said this in the meeting. It's the kind of watch you look at even in the press images. It doesn't dazzle you or anything, but you get it immediately. It's just well designed. And putting it on, it has very similar proportions to the Explorer.
Yeah.
So it wears extremely true to size. And similar to what I like about the H08 or even sort of the time-only slim to Hermes type stuff is... the little details get all of the attention. So the links of the bracelet, the clasp, the custom typography, the orientation of even the Hermes logo on the dial relative to the hands. It's extremely legible. Whether we were seeing it in steel or in the two-tone rose and steel configuration, I prefer the steel, obviously. There's just something really clear about the watch. And maybe it speaks to Hermes... and it's like storied past, but it understands how to design something.
I think it's just like very clean.
It is.
Without being like a derivative.
But the branding is so clear, don't you think?
But that's like Hermes.
Exactly. Yeah. But there's brands out there that can't.
So it's like you could look at that watch and be like Aquanaut.
You could.
Nautilus. But it isn't that in real life.
And that's the other thing. So the cut. The major, I guess, you know, design difference between it and a conventional watch is the 130.
Oh, right. The crown.
The crown at the top right of the case, which, you know, you think about 430 crowns on dive watches and things like that. Here, it was not done for any sort of, I don't know, thoughtless reason, but because the way that the cut is cut on the sides of the case, which are symmetrical, there was no way to put a crown at 3 o'clock. It would sort of disrupt the symmetry.
So it's beveled on each side.
It's beveled on each side.
Yeah. So there's like a contrast in the texture of the like polished and satin brushed. And then in order to keep the line, the integrity of the line, they've put the crown at 130. And it's the kind of watch that is clearly like being thought out by somebody who is like, it's designy.
It's designy.
Yeah. It's cool.
Malika, I want to keep it with you for just a second because we talked about these a little bit yesterday, Cartier and the Tiny Tanks, the Tiny Tank Louis, the Tiny Tank American. Obviously, kind of an extension of like what we've seen with the Banoir and these like really small watches. But I want to get your perspective on whether or not these watches are sort of successful in what they set out to do.
I think it's interesting because I sort of do that whole eye roll thing when people talk about tiny watches these days. But actually, there's something about the Tank Mini that I think only Cartier could do. What they've done, instead of making a tiny tank, they just have literally downsized the Tank Louis. Like, it's just a mini Tank Louis. Like
the
they
same
have,
proportions, just shrunken.
Yeah.
Honey, I Shrunk the Watch.
Well, did you see my deck in the... Yeah. You stole my deck in the CMS.
He edited that deck, baby.
You did?
Did you write that? Is this like something that's not published yet?
Yeah.
Didn't see it.
It's my We're deck on the same way. Honey, I Shrank the Tank.
There you go. There you go. I love that.
No. It's like the kind of thing where it's they're not marketing it as like the mini tank for ladies. It's just, here we are. We shrank the tank.
Shrank the tank.
Yeah.
I think someone also pointed out to me that the price is basically equivalent to, the love bracelet, like a gold love bracelet.
Right.
Or whatever.
Let's not put that watch though, like on the same sort of like, I don't want to put it in love bracelet world because I think it like, here's the thing. The Benoit bangle to me, that's jewelry. Mm-hmm. This is just like a tiny watch.
Yeah.
Well, I find it compelling for that very reason. Someone might buy this and be attracted to watches instead of a bracelet if they're just walking in
for a Cartier
thing.
What I was like so surprised by was Ben's reaction to it.
He was going nuts.
And I asked him and I was like, why is it that you like this watch so much? And he was like, because it's sort of like a new watch wearing experience for me. And he kind of, the fact that he's drawn to it makes me think it's not gimmicky, that it is just like a cool way of doing a small watch.
We talked about everything else from Cartier yesterday, the Tortue and everything else. And Danny and I spoke a little bit about the tiny tanks, as we're calling them now, whatever the actual name might be at Cartier. So I think we'll leave the discussion.
It's Tank Mini.
We'll leave the discussion there for the day. But before we get on to the next part of the discussion, become immersed in the essence of luxury with Lucid Motors, where every journey is an experience of unparalleled comfort and advanced technology. Lucid Motors' commitment to sustainability is not just in its electric innovation, but in every detail of the Lucid Air's design. Experience a new era of luxury travel with Lucid Motors, or learn more at lucidmotors.com. And as I've said every day, also, think about coming down to the studio here in Geneva. We've been enjoying our time here every day, recording after the show. It's a nice escape from the madness of the Palexpo. But Danny, speaking of the madness at the Palexpo, one of the most insightful things you've said to me, among many, if I may add, at the show today was that there aren't any big sort of headliner, hypey pieces like we saw last year, but a lot of the retailers, I ran into a retailer friend of mine from Chicago, actually, who said something like this. Some of the commercial folks that we know a little bit at the Hodinkee shop have said this. There are just a lot of good everyday watches that people are going to walk into their retailer, they're going to see on the Hodinkee shop, if I may be so bold as to plug our own
be
very
so bold.
Site. And they're just going to see these watches, they're going to buy them, and they're going to be their everyday watches that they might not even think about. But they're going to love them. They're going to wear them for a while. This is something you said to me when we were in the Oris meeting.
Yes.
Seeing the new Aquis. So I want you to talk about what they've done to sort of refine and update the Aquis. And if you want to zoom out a little bit and talk about like what I just said and explained from your perspective there after talking about Oris, that'd be great too.
Yeah. I mean, no, the Oris obviously revamped the Aquis in a way not dissimilar to how Rolex might quote unquote revamp the Submariner, which is just like if you looked at two Oris Aquis side by side, you're liable not to know you're looking at two different watches. Mm-hmm. So it's just improving a good solid dive watch and making it better. But my point is now it's sort of like twofold because I think there's a little bit of an issue with how the watch industry has been handling things, let's say the last 5 years, which is there have been serious hero pieces for brands every year. And the expectation then becomes that a brand needs to innovate and wow and surprise every release year. And that's difficult for an industry that expects you to buy something where the value proposition for any watch in the price segments of the ones we talk about is that they should ostensibly last forever. And even though like people collect watches and things like that, if you're only looking at the big hero pieces, you're missing sort of like the secondary stuff. And I think this year it's all secondary stuff.
But also, let's think about how most people buy watches and how many watches most people own.
I don't know if, you know, there'd be years where, like last year with the Oris Kermit, for example, to stay with Oris, because they rarely have a watch like that, where it comes out and you can sense the excitement. Therefore, you would feel compelled to buy it like today. Because
but isn't having a hero piece just a sort of marketing technique to get people into the sort of zone of the brand?
Totally, and that's why this year I'm assuming that friends like your retailers are probably like a little bit maybe thrown off by the energy, because most likely a lot of the sales they'll see will be months down the road as people sort of like digest and take this in and understand like there wasn't something that we needed to focus on, but that Oris Aquis Diver is a really solid choice. Or even the Hermes The Cut, which is like just a solid ass watch.
And people will buy that.
They will buy that watch, but you're not going to have like bum rush at the door of the Hermes boutique to get it. But you'll start seeing, I think, the cuts on more wrists than you might see in H08, I think.
100%.
Right? And so, again, like I want to reiterate, I said this on the first day, like this is a year where my favorite watch was a rose gold Day-Date. And like any other year, that would have been like the tertiary release. Like a watch that like I probably would have been like, that's fine. But like I'm really into whatever, like the lefty GMT or whatever it is. It's just like we're missed. Like,
we donn't have any tricks.
Yeah. And so with, when we were in Oris today, I realized like even speaking to like the brand a bit about it, I think everyone just treats this year as kind of like, you know, a palate cleanse.
Well, this is the way it used to be, right? Brands would announce things in April or in the spring or whenever the show was. SIHH was earlier in the year, and it wouldn't show up in retailers for, I don't know, until the holidays sometimes, right? This is the way things used to work. And it changed in the last few years when the industry got, like, you know, kind of frothy or whatever word you want to use, where there was a certain pride in, like, I don't know. I remember the Tudor Black Bay 58 Blue when they kind of just dropped that at their retailers one day in the middle of June 2020 or 2021. I can't remember what year. But there was a certain pride in being the first one to get the call, or you know, having people reach out to their ADs or their retailers right away, and like forming a list or a line for these like really in demand watches. And that's not the reality. Is that's not sustainable, right? That can only go on for so
long. Think about this. I'm wearing an Omega today, and if you think about Omega since January of 2023, has not. When it did the super racing with the spy rate, movement technology Tony and I are intimately familiar with. Since January of 2023, we are now in April of 2024. Omega has literally not released truly a new kind of watch. Last year they had that anniversary for the Seamaster. It was just a, you know, an array of dial colors for an entire collection. But like in the absence of the trade show on the periphery, because we all zero in on watches and wonders, like a brand like Omega is like had sort of a palate cleanse approach for a year and a half. And that's kind of interesting from like a market perspective.
What is that? Can you just unpack, like spin it forward? What does that mean, Danny?
I'm not really sure if it means that, you know, there needs to be a bit of course correction. And, you know, it's happened in the past in the watch world, whether it's like trends of color or trends of style come in. I think this is now like a self-referential realization that is simply not a sustainable way to operate.
Can somebody please talk to me about this green dial obsession? As somebody who's like, you know, I've only been in watches for like, what, 3 years now? I do not get it. Like, what is going on?
I truly don't know.
Why is green dial like innovation?
I don't even think so.
Is it because people like green? Like, somebody explain it to me.
So I personally think it, like, blue dial stuck at some point, right? Yeah. And has never stopped.
Okay.
And I just think at some point, and probably if we had to think about who spearheaded this, if you can really remember, and let's say the last like 3 years.
What's that, 2005 GMT?
Could be. but isn't it always isn't it always Rolex?
Yeah, well, I guess because they're the color green. Like, I don't know somebody.
And then there was the green aqua, or the green Nautilus. Remember that?
Right.
And so when
you before that, it was the Mare Daytona.
Right. Rolex.
Sure, again, Rolex.
When did we run that, Will? In 18 or 19?
No, I think it was that episode of Talking Watches. Yeah. But that watch was a 2016 release because I think
right,
it
but
was,
it got
yeah.
hot.
But it was
a nothing watch.
Yeah, exactly.
A nothing watch, yeah.
Hey, so maybe John Mayer did it.
Maybe, you know, it all goes back to that, I suppose.
It just feels very sort of like everybody talking about trends, but to me it doesn't, it's like, what are we talking about?
A trend's not a trend when it's manufactured, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Malika, I think you've made this point in an article. there are so many like mini niches in the watch world where it feels like everything is a trend, which means nothing is a trend.
Yeah.
We talk about it. So I don't want to mention the...
Here's I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Here's the Piaget mention, Malika, but we talk about these types of things all those types of trends and the broader things for jewelry watches, yeah. whatever. We've talked about it on the podcast. Yeah. We're not going to talk about it again.
I feel like Green Dials is like the mass market equivalent of being into Piaget for vintage people.
Maybe it is. Blue and green are the most universally loved colors. Oh, and
the Rolex Hulk. Remember that watch? That was a very popular watch.
Yeah. I do remember that watch.
Do you remember that watch?
I'm shocked. I didn't remember that watch. Yeah. That was like a truly transformationally popular watch.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for reminding us about.
Sorry, John Mayer.
One of the most transformational watches of the past 20 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but it also is as simple as the fact that like the sky is blue and the grass is green. So these are the most. These colors are in our DNA, guys.
Damn, that was good.
No, I read this in a book about art recently.
Oh, cool. And they're also reading about art.
No, it's quite universal, actually. The most, they've done studies about this. Our eyes in the art world are drawn to paintings, whatever, that are blue and green. These are the most popular colors.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, naturally.
You should read Werner's Guide to Color.
Yeah, we'll take that into consideration.
Tony and I saw a green watch today that I can't talk about. We both liked it.
Right.
So, sorry.
Okay, we've got two more brands we're going to talk about pretty quickly, guys. They kind of fall into the same general category for me of these like classic, traditional, dressier watches, might I say. Danny, a couple of weeks ago, you came out here and you saw the new Chopard releases. I wrote a couple of them up for the intros on the site. I haven't seen the Chopard stuff. We haven't had an appointment yet.
That's right.
But you've seen some of the watches. They did a new Qualité Fleurier.
Love
how was my pronunciation?
Qualité Fleurier.
As well as another.
Qualité Fleurier.
Much better.
As well as another LUC with a sector style dial, and then a another Alpine Eagle that I know you want to talk about a little bit. So give us the rundown on Chopard and what they continue to sort of do right or differently.
I think Chopard is doing, well, it has like three distinct lines that it likes to operate in from its sort of like grown popularity. And one is the Alpine Eagle. One is this sort of like traditional LUC sort of dressier side of things. And then you have the Mille Miglia side.
Well, what about Happy Diamond?
And of course, Happy Diamonds. So let's say four. That's actually really true.
Yeah, may not like it.
I will admit that's the most popular watch.
But people wear Happy Diamonds.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
And I have a happy lamp to remind
neon
me of
sign.
That. So it's hard to say that I forget about
right.
that. But when I saw the watches at the Chopard manufacturer, I wasn't expecting to really love them as much as I did. And especially like the LUC stuff, which I know you're particularly a fan of. The Qualité Fleurier it's a beautiful watch. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful execution in steel, I believe.
It's in steel for the first time. So they introduced the Qualité Fleurier. 2005 was the first model. They've always done it in precious metals. It's in Lucent steel, Danny.
Lucent steel.
Don't you forget.
Proprietary.
For the first time this year.
Love proprietary steel.
So it's under $20,000, which is really exciting, actually. Basically, let's just call it the QF. I don't know if that's sort of what they use,
let's
but we'll
call
it that. It's just basically a super certification. They do some other things beyond Geneva seal and chronometer certification to really oomph the technical interest for people that are interested in that. Give it a little oomph, Malika. But it's actually an independent certification board that Chopard and four other manufacturers based out there founded in the early 2000s, and not a ton of brands submit to them still, so it's cool to see that Chopard is still kind of committed to that. The sector style dial on the other LUC is nice as well. The reality is, though, these are 40 millimeter watches. They're big watches. The sector dial fills it in, but it's still going to wear a little bit big on the wrist, but I think the design helps. It gives it a little bit more of a compact effect, and at least there's more going on there than in previous iterations. But Danny, what'd you think of the Alpine Eagle that they did?
So you know, and Malika knows, I'm an Alpine Eagle fan. Malika, you're an Alpine Eagle fan.
I actually am, earnestly, an Alpine Eagle fan. And I am also, weirdly, sort of a bit of a secret open work fan.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's probably AP brainwashing.
For sure.
without
because we all know where mine
it happens to lies. The best of us. Yeah.
I like it. If you, yeah. So I think obviously when I saw that, I haven't seen it in person, but all I could think of was the San Moritz that Phil Toledano.
Yes.
Actually, probably recently sold because he's always flogging his watches on Instagram. But I was really into that. And so it was cool to see kind of like the 2024 version. Sort of, that was like a weird coincidence, maybe.
Super. And also, yeah. I mean, the watch is, it's made in titanium, which is even.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the point of this watch. It's like super lightweight. Like, what's the size?
It's the same 41 millimeter. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot of dial.
And you know what's cool about this watch and even the XPS, which was last year's.
Oh, I love that
XP
watch.
Variation, which.
That was a great watch.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but these are the LUC laden versions of the Alpine.
Yeah.
So they're generally. Schuppard is low key killing it.
No, they're killing it.
Like, I forgot how much I like that watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
And so this one with the titanium. Last year with the salmon dial, and with the salmon dial watch, I believe introduced was the bracelet with a trigger deployant on the back. Because this, what's really obnoxious, this is a super pedantic thing.
You are being insane.
I can't take off the bracelet if I have no reference point to take it off from.
Okay, right.
So when it's a butterfly clasp, I have to stick my finger underneath the bracelet to get it off. Now I have two little buttons on the side. I've been told it's going to come to the entire Alpine Eagle range, but it's on this titanium version. It's open worked. It's beautiful in person.
Did you try it on?
I did try it on.
And light as a feather?
Light as a feather. Yeah. You can weirdly see your arm, your skin through the other side of it.
What's that like?
It's not my favorite.
Okay.
But that watch is one of my favorites of the show.
I think it's kind of sick.
Another brand that I kind of associate with Chopard in a way is Parmigiani, which... I saw these watches today. You all have not seen these, right?
We didn't see the Toric, no.
Okay, so the big news from Parmigiani is they've relaunched the Toric collection. It's kind of the...
That's your collection, isn't it?
How do you mean?
I don't know. I feel like that's sort of your...
Well...
Why do I associate that with you?
Well, let's get into it and see if it is or is not my collection. Here's the thing. They re-released the Toric after kind of quietly letting it go the last few years while they focused on the PF, kind of the sportier watch, right? One of the more elegant sports watches on the market, in my opinion. And they've done some great things with that. But this year they focused on the Toric, which was kind of originally released in the 90s. It has this quite neoclassical vibe if you look at the original watches that they released.
Well, that's why I associate it with you then.
I'm neoclassical?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I get that a lot. It had these bezels that were kind of inspired by Roman columns. And it's an acquired taste, honestly, but a lot of people have been digging it a lot lately. The vibe.
Digging.
They've been digging the Toric. But for this new release, they did a couple of things. First of all, aesthetically, they really minimalized everything.
It feels very much in line with a lot of what Parmigiani's doing.
Yeah, it's what they did with the PF, right? The dial is super minimal now. The cases as well, a lot cleaner. But the other thing they did was upsize it to 40 millimeters. So they released time-only watches in 40 millimeters in platinum and in rose gold. And then they've also got this beautiful Rattrapant that's 42 millimeters.
This seems quite strange to upsize.
I agree.
Right now.
Yeah. I agree. And I think it's kind of the lugs are relatively short, so it doesn't wear terribly on wrist. And I think... Perhaps if the PF collection is any indication, they'll give us the 36 millimeter version later down the road. But if you're going to relaunch a collection like this, I think you've got to have something more than a 40 millimeter watch nowadays. If it's going to be a dress watch, that's all minimal.
What's
dial.
The price point on this?
So the other thing is, if you look at it, it's okay. I won't bury the lead. It's $50,000 basically for the platinum. The rose gold is the platinum is closer to 60 US. The platinum or the rose gold is about 50 US, I think. The movement is rose gold. It's finely finished. It's everything you would expect from Parmigiani. But it's a $50,000 watch. We talked about the 1908 on day one in platinum. That's a $30,000 watch, and it's. We just talked about Chopard. The QF is a $20,000 beautifully made dress watch that gets everything that Chopard has to offer. So it's a tough price point, especially at 40 millimeters. You're not offering something that people aren't going to look to Patek, Rolex now, Chopard, any other number of brands. So I think I would have liked to see more from them in sizing in other things. But I will say, I saw the introduction article on our site on day one, and you do feel the quality of these watches in person in a way that's not conveyed. I think because it's
so simple.
Because it's so simple, you look at it and it doesn't look like much, but you do feel the craftsmanship and the quality when you handle them.
That brand is particularly good at being like very elegant and understated.
I agree. Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So I like aesthetically what they did because of the way it actually feels in hand is really, really nice. But I hope that they do more with the collection, especially in sizing. I think there's things they can do with complications as well. A Ratrapon is a fascinating place to start, but at probably 150,000 US and 40 pieces, it's something that I'll probably never see again and doesn't really move the needle on a more global scale. That said, it's interesting to see a new collection from Parmigiani, a brand that's been really fascinating to me over the past few years.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to add there? Should we close it there for the day?
Yeah, I'm just going to add this little sort of epilogue.
Go for it, please.
I really liked this very sort of outlandish pink sapphire J12. It's called the X-Ray. I knew Tony wouldn't let me talk about it unless I just went for it. I think it's really cool. I think Chanel are doing cool things, and I think you should pay more attention.
I didn't get to see it, but I saw James editing the photos, and so I'm excited to read your story.
It might not be your taste, but hey, they're doing something.
Chanel's always doing something very cool.
They don't care what anybody thinks. Yeah.
I appreciate Chanel in ways that I don't appreciate certain other brands. They knew who they are, and they don't really care what you think about them.
Yeah.
And you cannot say that for a lot of brands.
They truly do not care.
Danny, anything outlandish you want to add before we close out the show?
I don't want to add anything outlandish.
Yeah, neither do I. So this is day three at Watches and Wonders. We'll leave it there for today. We've got one more episode live from Geneva at Lucid Motors Studio. We're going to talk about a few more specific brands, but I think we'll take the opportunity to zoom out and talk about the show more broadly too. So look forward to that. And thank you as always for listening. Thanks to our video editor and audio editor, Joe Wyatt. And a special shout out to Will Holloway as well. I don't think he's got a shout out.
Hi, Will.
We love Will. Daddy Will.
Thank you all too for listening, and we'll see you again tomorrow.